Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is when Tracy recording. It is 12:47 p.m. Today is Pacific. It's Pacific summertime, and today is Friday, September 21st. So, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, there are lots of things to talk about in here this week. Not least the pullback that we saw on Indian banks in here today. The fact that Theresa May got a bit of a smackdown when she went to the EU's confab in Salzburg. But the most important thing that's happening in here this week is that the 10-year Treasury is above 3%. This is the second time this year that we've seen the yield above 3%, and it has to be said with a lot less fanfare on this occasion. So what exactly is going on? Well, a range is an explosion waiting to happen. That's something we talk about at the chart seminar. It's one of the big topics of conversation. And when a market is ranging, the arguments for in favor of both supply and demand are back in a relative equilibrium. So we know what the bullish case is. It's that the US is doing well, the economy is expanding, and that everywhere else, by comparison, isn't doing so great. And then you had the strength of the US dollar, which had been supporting US assets, and treasuries are certainly a US asset. So they were helping to, that strength in the dollar was helping to contain the yield from breaking above 3%. Well, the dollar started to weaken in here this week, so that may have been one of the factors in why yields were breaking upwards. But there is the additional point that there is an awful lot of additional debt that is being issued by the US Treasury, and that isn't something that is a small factor. So when you have, and just economics 101 is when there is excess supply, well, then the price will fall until it starts to get soaked up again. Well, if you have falling prices, you have rising yields. So now we're at a very important juncture because the Treasury yield is right in the region of the lows, or the highs on the yield that we saw back in April, and this is a potential area of support. Well, when we look at the futures contract for the 10-year, we can see that it is right on the region of the low. And there is a short-term oversold condition, but the much broader perspective is that there is a clearly defined downtrend. And that, yes, there is a short-term oversold condition, and it has been down now for four consecutive weeks, so it's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we may get some pause and consolidation in this area. And I think that's probably the base case scenario, but the much bigger picture is that this is a medium-term downtrend. And it's been trending downwards since 2016, so it's already 2 years and counting. But when we look at the long-term trend that we have in the US 10-year Treasury, well, what we're presented with is an incredible secular bull. Where yields contracted all the way from the early 1980s until really quite recently. And that was, and I think there won't be much argument, that it was a 35-year bull market that is probably now over. This is a very big issue because one of the reasons, I was chatting during the week with my daughter's fencing coach, who's just back from a wedding they attended in Sweden, and was contrasting how stable and clean and tidy the Swedish countryside is. And that's equally true of large parts of Europe, where social democracy has prevailed since at least the 1980s, and there has certainly been this attitude where it has been play along to get along. And the expansion of the social system and social services has been predicated on debt. Well, that works fine when you've got a small country with a small population and big exports, so you can afford to pay for it. Or when you're an energy exporter and you have got a big current account surplus. But it's problematic for countries that basically sacrificed their manufacturing sectors in the hope that the services sector would pick up the slack. But what has in fact happened is that they sacrificed their manufacturing sectors and exported them to Asia, but primarily to Asia. Then the services sector, replacing those manufacturing jobs, paid a lot less, so you had a lower standard of living. The social services that have been used to pick it up, pick up the slack, have been funded with debt. And debt financing works wonderfully as long as yields are falling. So the quantity of debt has expanded rather rapidly. Despite the fact that you have the... It's one thing to talk about debt to GDP ratios. But the other point, of course, is that when funding costs rise as a result of rising yields or inflation, then that tends to throw the debt to GDP ratio figures into out of whack. Because if your funding costs are rising, then you might only be refinancing the debt, but it's costing you a lot more. So it is really your repayment schedule in terms of the GDP ratio is probably the more appropriate way of thinking about the ability to pay. And this is the kind of situation that is probably going to become more of a consideration in future. I think the most important chart and one of the most illustrative that we have anywhere is the total return on 10-year treasuries, because it was the most consistent trend in the world until 2016. It only went up. And if you had simply bought treasuries and held on to them, well, the index started back in 1982 at 100, and it's now at 2066. So that's really not a bad performance over the course of this bull market. But one of the clearest lessons that we have from looking at decades of history and decades of experience with the markets is that when a previously consistent trend starts to form a broadening pattern, well, then that broadening pattern is not a particularly reliable continuation pattern, but rather that it has a much greater possibility of being a top. But if it's a top, it's a type 3 top, and type 3 tops are characterized by ranging, time, and size. Well, this is certainly ranging. It's been going on already for the better part of 3 years, and it's a pretty large one relative to the relatively small drawdowns that we've seen in the course of this incredible bull market. Well, when it eventually breaks the neckline on this top, well, then it's going to be categorically a new secular bear market. Well, then the question is, how are other assets going to be valued? Well, it means that equities are going to have to either grow considerably faster than the yield, or then we're going to have higher dividends, much higher dividends, in order to compensate for the higher yield that's available on treasuries. Pretty much everything in the world is valued off of the 10-year US Treasury. So when we think about what it is that we can anticipate here, well, does it have to unwind the entire bull market? That's obviously the big question when we look at something that has had a massive secular bull. Well, not necessarily. When, for example, we look at secular bull markets in stock markets, they do not go all the way back down. They pull back violently, but then they tend to stabilize and range for a prolonged period of time. And that is quite possible with treasuries. And not to mention that with something that trends for 35 years at a time, then the new bull market will not happen all at once. But this is obviously representing a significant risk. But how much of a clear and present danger is it today? That's perhaps the most important question. Because we can think about the fact that the fall in yields has been one of the contributing factors in the rising gap between, or the widening gap between, the rich and poor. It's been a contributing factor in the rise of social democracy. And then the response to the credit crisis with quantitative easing left and right has emphasized this massive gap between rich and poor. It has contributed to the rise of populism, not just in the USA or in the UK, but basically everywhere. And that is representative of the fact that the yield has fallen a long way already, and that in order for it to have the same effect, that it would have to be in substantially further negative territory. And then how can anybody make money when yields are negative? And that kind of situation, this is, I think, one of the most important points about any bull market. Crowds thrive on contradiction. So in any major bull market, particularly those that climax in manias, well, you can often see, and it's almost a hallmark of these advances, that there is a tolerance of contradiction. So, for example, in the 1990s, it was that earnings don't matter. Well, obviously, earnings do matter. And in heading up to the credit crisis, it was that we can give a loan to anybody and we can hedge the default risk. Well, not everybody can hedge the default risk. Somebody has to bear the default risk. Well, in every major bull market, there is the view that things are going to change and that it is going to be something that makes everybody's life better. But then you also get the condition when things get a little too quick, and then people start to engage in hyperbole. And when that happens, that's when you start to get contradiction. Well, the contradiction in the bond markets is that you can have upwards of $7 trillion that are yielding negative and still make money. Well, that's a logical impossibility. So eventually, that contradiction is going to be explored by the market. And with yields above 3%, then the question is whether we're getting it right now. Well, the other big resistance or support level for treasuries has been 3%, 3.25% on the 30-year, and it has not broken out. So what that would suggest, at least to me, is that so far, yes, we have got yields above 3%, but there is a short-term oversold condition. The 10-year future is at the lower side of its range and is quite oversold. Treasury yields have not yet broken up, and TIPS yields have not broken out, but they are trading at the upper side of a 5-year range. So what I think this suggests is that the most likely scenario in the short term is that we're going to get a bounce in the treasury markets, but there is enough inconsistency and lack and I think evolving top formation development in the bond markets to conclude that all we're going to get is a short-term bounce, and that the medium to longer-term prognosis is that we're going to have higher yields. Well, for as long as the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, and they're going to raise interest rates again this month. Well, the other point, of course, is that if, when we do think about countries where there are lots of negative yielding bonds, well, Germany has to be front and center. And even out to 5-year maturities, it's still yielding negative in here right now. But the ECB has stopped buying bonds, and that's having a longer-term effect. Because they took the size of their balance sheet up from 2 trillion to 4.6 trillion in the space of 4 years. And that was a phenomenal quantitative easing program. And it has contributed to negative yields on trillions of dollars of bonds. But the reality is that it's now over. And that means that there is some pressure coming to bear on the countries that are most susceptible, are most reliant on that ECB buying. So the Greek stock market is trending lower again, and it was in positive territory in here today, but golly, it has a lot of work to do to break that downtrend since January. If we look at just, for example, one of the Greek banks, then it's probably better to simply just look at a daily chart, you can see that there's been this substantial deterioration since April. Well, then when we look at what's going on in Italy, when populist administrations get co-opted by the status quo, then they get eviscerated at the polls the next time there's an election. And that is the real risk that the populist parties in Italy's government run right now. Either they're going to follow through on their commitment to massively expand the budget, or they're going to toe the line handed down by Frankfurt. Well, so far the stock market has bounced, and it is now right in the region of the trend mean. This is about where, if demand is going to be reasserted, it's going to keep going from here. If not, well, we're at the upper side of what is effectively a 9-year range, and on any other occasion it's got up to this level, it has pulled back in a violent manner. And that's something that is hanging out there as a potential outcome for the Italian stock market, not least because of the quantity of government debt that the banks hold. Nonetheless, there is the likelihood that the populist parties are going to toe the line simply because Italy has got a mountain of debt that needs to be refinanced in the next few years. So that is bringing the yield back down. It's coming down to the lower side of this range that has been forming above the base. So this is a first step above the base. If it's a first step above the base, then the region of the trend mean will represent an area of resistance for the price and support for the yield. If that in fact does happen, well, the higher yield has been sustained, and what the market is sending is a very clear signal that Italy's debt needs to be downgraded. Well, that's certainly a potential outcome from the current environment. The longer yields stay higher, the more that the stock mar the bond market is voting that Italy should be downgraded. Well, there has been an awful lot of commentary in here this week about the fact that the dollar's advance is over. Well, I'd be inclined to think that it might be a little bit premature to reach that conclusion. That certainly the euro had a pretty impressive day on the upside yesterday, and more importantly, it was able to break above the high that we saw back in August. So now we can start to talk about the progression of lower rally highs having been broken, but it really does need to sustain this advance. And the big question is, realistically, when is it that the ECB is going to raise interest rates? I'd be inclined to think that it's going to be at least a year. And even then, is Europe going to go a year without some form of crisis that isn't going to necessitate that they re-engage with quantitative easing? This is a very big question for Europe, considering the strife that a number of its constituent members are currently in. And we certainly haven't yet explored the eventuality of what happens when the ECB stops buying. So these are potential outcomes. Well, what I find also interesting is that the Euro Stoxx index has been ranging for the better part of 18 months, and it has come back now to test the region of the trend mean and the progression of lower rally highs. So it's at a do or die moment. It's either going to break up out of this level or not. But the much bigger perspective is that this market has been ranging in an incredibly volatile market since 1999. And this range has been going on now for 18 months. Well, it's either a consolidation and the market is going to muster the wherewithal to break above 400 and potentially then also break out to new all-time highs, or this is an evolving top formation and the market is going to fail at this level. Well, that is the extent. Those are two very wide outcomes, and this is a comparatively narrow range, going really from 380 to 400. So the trading has certainly compressed, and the potential outcomes are really quite extraordinarily wide. So there is certainly the potential that when the European market breaks, it's going to do so in a very dynamic manner, and that could be either up or down. And its ability to break back above the trend mean and to break the months-long progression of lower rally highs is a big question at the present moment. Well, when we think then about the challenges that Europe represent, well, what we're also presented with is that a lot of that is already in the price. And the PE is at around 16, which is not especially challenging considering that the S&P 500 is more than 21. But the Japanese market is trading at an even lower PE ratio, and that's currently at about, well, following the move that we've had in the last few days, it's gone up to 17. But when we look at its financial analysis, well, the Nikkei has got a PE of about 17, and the much broader TOPIX index has got a PE somewhere around 14 or 15. But then when we think about the price to book, the Nikkei is at about 1.9. When we look at the TOPIX price to book is 1.35. The Euro Stoxx index has got a price to book value in the region of 1.69, but the S&P 500 has got a price to book in the region of 3.54. So there is a lot of good news has been priced into the S&P over the course of the last while. Well, obviously the US has got the benefit of having transitioned seamlessly from monetary policy stimulus to fiscal policy stimulus. And the stock market has done pretty much nothing but go up despite the six-month hiatus that we had at the beginning of this year in response to that. Well, eventually, all the money that was brought back from overseas will have been spent either on dividends or share buybacks, or potentially, who knows, there might even be some capital expenditure on additional plant and machinery. But the reality is that the S&P broke out to new all-time highs this week. And this continues to represent really quite an impressive uptrend. And the market was a little bit softer in here today, but it's going to close out the day pretty much unchanged. This was also quadruple witching for options. So it's perhaps not so surprising that we get a little bit of a pause and consolidation as options contracts are rolled forward, or people take the decision to execute before they expire. We probably will therefore have a more normal market environment at the beginning of next week. But when we look at the long term for the S&P, well, what we're presented with are these extraordinarily long ranges, and these ranges tend to be one above another, and they tend to persist for decades, or anything between 13 and 17 years. Well, the most, and I really do say 13 years because that's how long the last one was, but previous to that we've had ranges that have persisted for 17 years, and the bull markets have a habit of persisting for anything up to 20 years. Well, the breakout really only happened in 2013. So this market could continue higher for 20 years after that and take us up to 2033. If we look at the Dow Gold ratio, then we're also presented with 35 years between the peaks. Therefore, the next peak would be somewhere in around the 2035 area. So that takes our estimate between 2033 and 2035, when this secular bull market will eventually end. So how on earth do we square those two outcomes, where it looks increasingly likely that the bond markets have climaxed, that we are in a position now where there is increasing evidence of top formation development hinging on completion. And we have a stock market which has been rallying in a very impressive manner for 10 years already and could potentially rally for another 17 years. Well, this is a very big question. Well, of course, nothing goes up in a straight line, and nothing comes down in a straight line either. That the advance in yields that is likely as a result of the adoption of fiscal stimulus is not something that's going to happen overnight. The rise of populism, though, also increases the potential that we're going to have fiscal stimulus become more of a pattern elsewhere beyond the USA. One of the conclusions, I guess something that we can think about, is that the USA was the first into the crisis, and it was the first out, because it took corrective action early in terms of recapitalizing the banking sectors and writing down bad loans through the foreclosure crisis. But then it engaged in quantitative easing, and now it's engaging in fiscal stimulus. And that fiscal stimulus is a direct appeal to the people that have been left on the sidelines because of quantitative easing. Quantitative easing resulted in a massive transfer of wealth from savers to traders. And that has contributed to this widening gap between rich and poor. Well, fiscal stimulus tends to both create inflation, and there's going to need, governments are going to need to have some inflation if they're going to get out from the massive debt piles that have been accumulated. But what it also helps to do is improve the pricing power of stocks. Then, when we think about that, then there is the potential that we could be in for a more choppy environment. We could certainly be in for an environment where leadership changes in the stock market. But if we do get some inflation, then that will help to stoke investor demand, and they'll start looking for hedges. Well, right now the yield on cash is actually above the yield on the S&P 500. If the S&P 500 didn't also have the share buybacks, which have been such an incredibly important factor over the course of this year, and indeed over the course of most of this bull market, then we probably would have, I think the main point is that you can't simply look at dividend yield any longer because of so many share buybacks. So it's really the total return and the kind of return that one would have to give up to hold money in a money market fund is rather meaningful. There are very clear secular bull trends that continue to animate markets. We can think about these in terms of the rise of the global consumer. And that is increasingly happening in places that have got the potential for a demographic dividend. Well, most particularly, that's India, Indonesia, Nigeria, and a lot of Africa. That's where all the young people are. So if we're thinking about the rise of the global consumer, well, the rise of the Chinese consumer has already happened. And now we're looking for the next market. Well, now the big challenge is the ability of underdeveloped economies to progress, because the pace of technological innovation is such that we have a huge number of companies that are actively engaged in reducing the number of workers that are required to complete rather mundane tasks. So what that, I think, represents is a challenge. China is building more industrial robots than anyone, and it really wants to hold on to the moniker of workshop of the world, despite the fact that large numbers of particularly low-end manufacturing have already moved to places like Vietnam, Cambodia, Kenya, and Ethiopia. They want to ensure that they hold on to the higher value ones. And most particularly, they want to hold on to the kinds of industries that are required to feed and clothe and employ the domestic population. But China's population is rapidly aging. And that's an important factor. It creates stability. So it's unlikely that we're going to have a student-led riot or a student revolution like we had in the late 1980s, simply because students as a percentage of the population have decreased considerably. It's exactly the same reason why we don't have people out stamping in the streets in Europe, because the people that really vote and are engaged are generally older. People don't also tend to go out and make a big fuss and bring down governments until they're starving, or until inflation in foodstuffs becomes a significant problem. And that's just not an issue in China right now. There is still this compact between the Communist Party and the people that they can, if they can deliver higher standards of living, then they can hold on to power. And the longer that that persists for, well, then the greater the likelihood is that it will continue to be able to persist simply because there are not enough young people to overthrow the government. What we have seen this week is that the Chinese market has rallied. And it rallied for three of the last 4 days. We had an upside key reversal on Tuesday, upside follow-through on Wednesday, and a better performance in here today. And this is starting to stand out on the chart. So China has been pulling back all year, primarily because they have been leaning heavily on the financial sector. And particularly it's the non-listed banks or the regional banks that have been the subjects of that pressure. They've been clamping down on the shadow banking sector. They've been clamping down on US dollar denominated debt, and they've been clamping down on the abuse of regulations. So that has contributed to a significant decline in the stock market, but now they have to do more. And what Li Keqiang was making an announcement just the last few days, saying that they are going to reduce tariffs further on the goods that they import. So that's certainly a positive development. They've also said that they are, at least Li Keqiang has said, they're not going to use the renminbi as a trade weapon. I wonder what people are asking about. Well, were they not using it as a trade weapon between March and August? And certainly the renminbi was a little bit weaker in here today. There is, of course, the point that China doesn't have a free press, and it doesn't have respect for minority shareholder interests, and it doesn't have an independent judiciary. Neither does it have a democratic institutions. It doesn't have rule of law. And it has an autocratic system, which is led by a dictator. And it is adopting increasingly fascist tendencies. Well, that is part of the reason why some of the largest companies have been pulling back. Precisely because the central government has made it their business to interfere in the profit motivation of these companies. But even Tencent, which has been pulling back so very aggressively, has begun to steady in here. But it has still got a lot of work to do before it can break that progression of lower rally highs. And Alibaba, having broken down from its most recent range, has not yet been able to push back up into it. So when we look at what's going on in the A-share market, it's not necessarily the technology companies are doing better, but that we're starting to get institutional support coming in for the banking sector. And the banks were in sharply positive territory in here today. So we can now start to think that this decline in the banking sector in China is over, and that at least a low of near-term, potentially medium-term significance has come into this market. And that's a really big change relative to the kind of decline that we had from the beginning of this year. We're starting to get the first, indications that there is a something of a state sponsorship to arresting the decline that we've seen in Chinese assets. So the H-share index in Hong Kong has also bounced in here this week, and it is right now in the region of the upper side of this evolving range. But of course, anyone who's got any experience of reading charts will be looking at the region of that trend mean and be thinking, well, golly, it needs to get above that. And upside follow through next week would certainly confirm that. And that is part of the reason why copper has rallied in such a dynamic manner in here this week. Copper was up nearly 11 cents in here today. It has emphatically broken its progression of lower rally highs, and it has already closed that overextension relative to the trend mean. Well, copper is often referred to as Dr. Copper because it is used in every country in the world, but it might just as easily be considered to be called Dr. China, because China is such an important source of demand for the commodity. But with the Chinese market starting to turn, then we are getting some interest coming back into the industrial resources. So the LME Metals Index has steadied. Now, it won't be updated again until Monday, but it is likely to be pushing back up towards 3,000 by Monday. Then, when we look at, for example, the zinc price, which has been the one that has fallen most aggressively, it's already starting to show signs of that oversold condition being on the cusp of being unwound. And it has rallied on consecutive days. That is just about a higher reaction low. Well, that's encouraging from the long-term perspective, because if we are in the latter stages of a medium-term bull market, and I do think that we are getting there. We've already seen last year that there was acceleration in the cryptocurrency markets, and that was, I think, a clear message that this belief in new markets and that this new technology was going to change the world had already arrived. But we're also starting to now see acceleration coming through in the cannabis shares, particularly with Canada moving towards a full legalization of recreational use. Then when we look at oil prices, well, despite the fact that the industrial resources had pulled back extraordinarily violently, oil prices have been really very steady, and they continue to trend higher. Well, Brent crude has paused around this $80 area. It hasn't quite been able to push above it just yet, and it gave up just about all of its advance in here today. Well, on the one hand, Saudi Arabia said early this week that they are more than happy to see prices above $80, and yet today prices were coming back because OPEC was saying that they may pump more. But so far, this has been a relatively contained consolidation in September. And as long as it's holding the $75 area, then I think the most likely scenario is that we are going to see a break on the upside. But I don't think that we're going to see prices surge. If we think about the consistency of the trend, then the next area of potential resistance is another $10 increment higher, which would take us up to $90. It's when oil prices surge higher. Just like we saw in the period before the credit crisis, that they represent a headwind for economic growth. But I think it is now open to interpretation just how much of a headwind it's going to represent for the USA when it is on the cusp of becoming a net energy exporter. I think there's a good argument that it's already energy independent because it's already exporting. We're probably not quite there yet on energy independence, but certainly the USA is not far away from it. Well, rising oil prices are good for the domestic energy sector. And the oil and gas producers have really been out in the cold and haven't been getting a lot of love over the course of the last few years. So they did bounce from the region of the trend mean in here. And if oil prices do move above the $80 area, well, it isn't simply that the conventional oil and gas producers will do better, but also the potential for the higher cost producers, especially offshore or the Canadian oil sands, should do better. if oil prices do in fact move above the $80 level. Well, we can see, for example, that Suncor Energy is now right back in the region of its trend mean. And Royal Dutch Shell, having broken emphatically higher earlier this year, has come back to bounce from the region of the trend mean as well. And the share right now is yielding just over 5.3%. Well, when we think about what the outlook for the global economy is, that we do have the rise of the global consumer. There are about 2 billion people that are going to enter the middle classes as consumers over the course of the next 20 years. And that represents a substantial growth driver for just about everything. Then we have technological innovation. Well, technological innovation most particularly is in the healthcare and in the energy sectors, because something that can really change there can improve global productivity beyond recognition. Well, the fact that you have hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling and better geophysics in the energy sector, which has led to previously untapped resources reaching market, that's a game changer. That's been a game changer for a decade, and it continues to represent a game changer, not least because the US has turned from being the biggest importer to being an exporter. It's now the biggest producer of oil and gas, larger than either Russia or Saudi Arabia. So even every other factor taken away, that is something that can drive a big bull market. But what we're seeing at the moment is the convalescence of a whole realm of different technological innovations that are improving productivity and helping to drive this secular bull. Well, immuno-oncology, genetic sequencing, and CRISPR gene editing technology, these are game-changing for the cancer sector. Well, oil prices or energy prices are a tax on growth and consumption, then so is cancer. And it costs trillions of dollars every year to treat cancer. Well, the number of cancers that can be treated successfully has increased substantially. So that is something that can enhance the productivity of economies generally. Then there is synthetic biology, so that scientists can now simply write the code for genetic programs and create solutions out of nowhere. Then we have big data. Well, big data is one thing, but the interpretation and the artificial intelligence required to make sense of it is even more important. So we're really only at the dawn of what's possible. And some of the innovations that are really being enhanced by artificial intelligence and big data analytics are that previously it took days to test the plasma in test fusion reactions. What happens inside a fusion reactor is that you tend to get solar flares in much the same way that happens in the sun. And they needed to try and model how that happens so that they could alter the plasma and the magnetic field accordingly in order to contain it more effectively. Well, it took days, if not weeks, to figure out how to do that manually. Whereas artificial intelligence can iterate through the potential outcomes and come up with a model in hours for the entire data set rather than days for one. That is massively accelerating the pace of innovation within the energy sector with regard to fusion. We get a similar condition in the healthcare sector, where there is an active program underway to map the human brain. But the quantity of data is somewhere in the region of 5 petabytes, which is the equivalent of all of Google's processing power, and that's simply for one brain. When we think about where this is going, then the potential for quantum computing and optical computing as being the solutions to the end of Moore's law are there. There's money flowing into these sectors now because they represent they represent the real innovations that are going to help drive the semiconductors. And well, it will no longer be the semiconductor sector when these technologies mature. Well, what is interesting right now is that the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index has lost momentum pretty significantly over the course of this year so far, but it has also held the progression of higher reaction lows, and it absolutely needs to continue to hold that 1325 area if the benefit of the doubt is going to continue to be given to the upside. And this, I think, is a index that really does bear watching. When we look at where the leadership is in this particular portion of the bull market, when we look at this market, there is the potential for acceleration. If we think about the psychological perception stages of bull and bear markets, well, even the Nasdaq was in disbelief back in 2008. By the time we got around to 2013 and 14, people were certainly expecting and accepting that this was a big bull market. But the pace of the advance has really started to pick up since the tax cuts went through. And that's mostly because of buybacks. And the buybacks have been an incredibly important factor in Apple being able to move higher. Well, now it is due some consolidation, and it does look like it is going to get some consolidation. So that is, I think, something to pay particular attention to, that we're getting some rotation within the stock market right now, and some of the larger technology companies are susceptible to some pause and consolidation. Google, for example, has pulled back below the $1,200 area. Amazon, which has been going up pretty much in a straight line for the last while, has also had a somewhat larger pullback than at any time we've seen in the last few months. Now, it is still holding this $1,900 area. And each of those reactions, particularly in June and July, were approximately $100. So it could still rally and reassert this advance. But what we're starting to see is that the somewhat more defensive sectors are starting to do a little bit better. And for example, the consumer staples has pushed up and away from its trend mean. And this is a pretty substantial rebound from what had been a very deep pullback. So I think that's a significant issue that we are at potentially now at a point where we're going to get some rotation into the kinds of assets that have got yields that can compare to the rise in government bonds. Then, if we are looking at the cyclical sectors, well, commodities are starting to rebound, and biotechnology has so far held this move up and out of the range that persisted from the middle of last year to the middle of this one. And then we're starting to get the mining sector doing better as well. Well, if energy and mining and the biotechnology sector start to return to a position of outperformance, well, that's generally the signal that we're in the latter stages of the third psychological perception stage, that it's when you get cyclical sectors turning to really very clear positions of outperformance. Well, that's when people start to get enthusiastic. They're looking around for bargains. It's usually when growth is doing well, but that interest rates have not gone up so much that they are a headwind. And that's exactly the situation we're in right now. Well, eventually we are going to have another recession, and the chances are that that will be a point when government bond yields will start to come back down again. The big question is that if they break out now and rally somewhat, well, when they do pull back, are they going to go all the way back down to the lows that we saw a few years ago, or is the yield going to find support in the region of the upper side of the base? Well, in order for the secular bear market in bonds to be credible, well, then a first step above the base would need to form to conclusively break the downtrend in the yield. So that is also, I think, a testament to just how early we are in a secular bull market for bonds, and that the case has not been conclusively made just yet, but that the balance of probabilities is certainly pointing in that direction. Well, the other market that I think people are certainly looking at with a certain sense of trepidation is gold, because the price has been holding here around the $1,200 area for a month. And it was down about $8 in here today, but it had been down about $12 in early trading. And now the question is it going to be able to continue to hold this $1,200 area and break up and away from it, or is it going to fail? And so far, platinum has been able to bounce more. Platinum didn't quite hold all of its advance in here today, but it was up for four consecutive sessions, so it's a little bit overbought in the short term. But I think we really do need to look at the weekly charts for, I think, a real indication that the trend is under pressure. It's been trending down for all of this year, and $800 is a previous area of psychological support. So this is about where support should be found, and it is in fact happening. But silver and gold have yet to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. And it really is for the bulls to prove. This market has been pulling back for a while already. Well, part of the reason that it has been pulling back is because of dollar strength. So let me return to look at the dollar. Well, the dollar index is right in the region of its trend mean. And now the question is whether it is going to sustain a move below it. It has pretty much unwound about half of the big decline put in 2017. And that simple unwinding of half the decline has put incredible pressure on emerging markets. So the ability of the Argentine peso to hold its low, despite the fact that you have 60% interest rates, is conditional on the US dollar's advance moderating. If the dollar starts to firm from here, well, then that is going to put additional pressure on some of these weaker emerging markets. But in the meantime, they have both put in higher reaction lows, particularly the Turkish lira. So we have at least a low of near-term significance, and there is potential here for an unwinding of oversold conditions relative to the trend mean. But I don't necessarily think that, well, obviously when you have an enormous decline such as we have had with Turkey, then people will start to look on it as a potential bargain. And it could be. But it didn't fall because there's no risk. And when you do get these kinds of declines, there is always the question whether you go for where the epicenter of risk is, and the epicenter of risk is definitely Argentina and Turkey, or do you go for the places that don't have the problems but were the victim of contagion selling? So I think at this point, it's probably worth starting to look for the those that really were damaged by contagion selling. And the Thai market is one of those. The Thai baht had weakened, and now it is strengthening up again, and the SET index is breaking back above the trend mean. The Vietnamese market has steadied again from the region of the trend mean, and when we look at the dong, well, it's in fact it's been a little bit steadier over the course of the last while. So when we do think about these emerging markets, then we do have the potential to get buying opportunities as a result of some contagion selling. Now the big question is, what's going to happen next with India? The Nifty index has pulled back today to the region of the trend mean. Its Yes Bank has been the primary contributor to the big pullback that we saw on the banks index. Well, if we look at the constituents of the Bombay Banks Index, and their relative, well, their absolute performance in here today. Well, Yes Bank was down 28% and HDFC Bank was up 0.33%. But the vast majority of these banks were down less than 4%. So there is the potential for trouble with the bad loans problem in India starting to come to the fore. And that could act as a bit of a headwind for the stock market at present. But right now, it has pulled back to the region of the trend mean and steadied. And this is about where, if support is to be found, well, it should be happening. Well, the JP Morgan India Trust has been underperforming all year. It had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend in January. And this looks like a first step below the top, or a type 2 top with right-hand extension. It absolutely needs to bounce next week, or this is going to look like a very messy chart indeed. Well, India generally is best bought following big reactions, and it is volatile enough that we do get those kinds of reactions. And that would suggest that there is the potential for bargain hunting to start to come into India if this selling pressure picks up a little bit further. But India also is benefiting from this digital and demographic model that it's got the digitization that is sweeping the country. Then it's got hundreds of millions of young people that can help to drive the growth in the economy if they're given the chance. And that suggests that this is a market that not only has these bullish factors, but also has rule of law, respect for minority shareholder interests, and independent judiciary. So when we compare it with China, then it does stand out as a longer term, more positive prospect. But in the short term, it looks like China is probably going to outperform. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.